Well, whether you've been birding your whole life or maybe you aren't sure how to tell a robin from a cardinal, I bet you've seen a raptor in flight or maybe perched along the road and marveled at how majestic it is. Larry Mueller here. We talk about birds pretty often on the show, and there's a reason, because it seems people can't get enough of it. And especially around migrations, there's so much to talk about. Richard Crossley is an internationally acclaimed birder, photographer. He's been a guest on our program in the past. He's been birding since the age of 7, and by 21, he'd hitchhiked more than 100,000 miles chasing birds across his native Britain and Europe. His most recent guide is the Crossley ID Guide Raptors. With us by phone, Richard, well, let's see here. I suppose I better push the button to get you on the air here. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Real pleasure.
Great to be on again, Larry. Thanks a lot.
Oh, man, I'm telling you, this book is stunning.
Well, thank you very much, Larry. I appreciate it, mate.
It is absolutely stunning, and we're going to get into it. You credit growing up in the British birding culture as turning you into a birder, and the birder you are today. How do you describe that culture?
Crazy, in a word. obsessed, madly passionate. You know, it's actually quite a different sport, I would say, to over here. To some degree, it's a young man's sport, certainly the world I started in, where we would chase birds initially all over the country and then literally all over the world. And so really a lot of young men, not so many women, on the really serious end of the scale. And it was those people that influenced me, and I wanted to be one of the boys. So I saw these people, you know, young kids who were younger than me, 13, 14, 15, who were hitchhiking all over the country and seeing all sorts of wild things. And, you know, I guess I wanted to be one of the boys, and it just kept growing from there.
Well, you certainly have a real passion for them, and it shows up in your books and your guides. What is it about raptors that really intrigues you?
I think I love all birds, actually, and raptors just as much as anything else. I mean, raptors are big and powerful, and one of the nice things is you can see these fantastic spectacles, hundreds and sometimes thousands on migration, and just the marvel of wondering how far they've come and how far they're going, I think is just great. And I think migration for me is probably the one phenomenon that drives me more than anything else, and nowhere is it more spectacular than with raptors.
Well, I'm telling you, and the plates in your book are absolutely stunning. And, you know, Marshall in Madison has a question that relates to learning about birds. Let's go to him, because I think that relates to kind of what you do with your books.
Mm-hmm.
Marshall, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thank you for taking me. It's fortunate that this came up, because I've been kind of stressing about this. Not really stressing, but like just thinking about it. My father's always been a birder. My sister is very good at it, and I'm just awful. And I've got all these neighbors, like, they go down and they work at hotels and other areas where birders come to follow the migration path. So like, it surrounds me, and I'm just awful. And I was wondering if you had any tricks to help to jumpstart or anything outside of getting the book, which I'm actually working on finding now.
Yeah.
But in any quick and dirty tips that I could use to help me out.
Thanks for calling, Marshall. You know, I often say it's called about learning to look, and really I look at birds and identify birds the same way as I identify people. And people always think that's a little strange when they hear that. But bird identification is really based on, for me, is based on size and shape. Just like with people. So, yeah, I'd be a white guy, but I'm really not white. I'm actually quite short. I'm 5'9", I weigh 190 pounds, so I'm quite broad, and I move a certain way. So it doesn't matter what clothes I'm wearing, or, you know, or what the time of day is or what the light is. People who know me well still know me just because of my size, my shape, and how I behave. And I would always say base bird identification first and foremost on that, and probability as well, and minimize the color aspect, because I think right now most people just look for color and focus, you know, nearly everything on the color, and that's really confusing, and it's so variable, it's almost impossible. So that would be my down and dirty trick, mm-hmm. is size, shape, because you know what? You're automatically going to see the color. You can't miss it. So start with size, shape, and behavior, what the birds are doing. Birds sort of follow the same patterns of behavior, just like people do. And so if you learn them, you know, that'll be a really big advantage to you.
Yeah.
And thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And in your books are a little different when it comes to, or quite a bit different, actually, than it comes to, I think, some of the older guides that are out there in terms of identification.
Yeah, I mean, I've tried to make them lifelike. Funnily enough, I've often asked myself, and still do, what is it about birding that I absolutely love, you know? And I started, like you were mentioning earlier, I actually started collecting eggs at 7 and birding hardcore, really 10, and I was really huge into sport. You know, I was asked to sign professionally at both soccer and cricket, every kid's dream in Britain, and I turned them down. And so you'd say, well, why would you, you know, when they had all these sports opportunities? What is it about birding that turned you on so much? And I really don't know the answer. But, you know, some of the things is that I can bird every minute of every day. It doesn't matter where you are. It's just constant. But a lot of it is to do with being outdoors. I just love being outdoors. Gives you license to travel, just like a bird. So there's so many aspects of it. So it seems to me that a book should have all of those aspects, not only the beauty of the birds and the behavior, because it's so interesting, but it should also have their environment as well, because that's fascinating to us as well. And funnily enough, all of those things are actually tied together. And so when you show a bird out of context, and out of context means it's on a white piece of paper and with no background, no habitat, it really doesn't make sense, because a bird's size and its shape and its behavior is all linked to the environment that it lives in. And so we should show the complete picture so it makes more sense to the mind.
Well, I'm telling you, the plates that you have in your book are absolutely stunning. We have a page up on my Facebook page that gives a hint of it, what your book looks like. But they really, really, you look at those plates and the birds in them in the context of the environment that they're in, and I think in terms of helping to identify is amazing.
Well, thank you. We did. You know, people want to be entertained. You know, and so we switched it up a bit more than other books. And, you know, one of the things, one of the beauties of the digital age and Photoshop is you can basically paint any photo you want with a photograph now.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we can make these in-focus scenes from near to far with photos, which you couldn't do before. We feel very fortunate. But people, as I said, like to be entertained in multiple ways. One is by the beauty and the behavior, but we're also able to put different lighting in there and make the scene more interesting like that.
Mm-hmm.
I was even a little naughty. I put a black and white page in there just to prove my point that you don't actually need color. And I've already had a few comments like, well, it's really quite easy in black and white, isn't it? And I'm like, yeah, it is. It's just about the patterns. It's not about the color. And so hopefully, you know, people will enjoy the fun side of it. I think people have always loved being quizzed and trying to work out the answers, you know.
Absolutely.
And that is, of course, the best way to learn is when you actually are put on the spot and you try and work out the answer, you know. And to me, birding is just a voyage of discovery, working it all out. And it's not about being right and wrong. It's just the fun that you have doing it.
Roger in Spring Green, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am about an hour west of Madison along the Wisconsin River, and on the backwaters right now we have lots of waterfowl passing through. And just a couple of days ago I was out looking at them, and there were hundreds of coots on the water, and there was an immature bald eagle trying to catch one. And that was very cool to watch, and it probably made 5 or 6 attempts by flying over them, and of course they're running like crazy on the water. And what was interesting to me was, you know, there are hundreds of coots in these rafts or these groups, and it's getting down really close, and yet it never got one.
Hmm. Yeah. Sometimes they do.
well, funnily enough, immature birds tend to do a lot more dummy runs than adults do. You know, and I guess they're sort of practicing or maybe just playing as well, or a combination of both of them. But the other thing is, you know, one of the reasons why birds are in large flocks is because when a raptor, a bird of prey, tries to get one of them for dinner, when it gets closer, invariably, they get confused because their eye gets distracted. They get taken off what initially was a subject, and they don't know which one to go for. And that second of hesitation invariably means that they actually miss their prey. You know, it almost confuses them. And so it's a great defense mechanism.
Yeah, great. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, great question.
Sam in Neenah, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I live in a Berlin area, and 20 years ago, there wasn't a very many turkey vultures flying around, which, in my opinion, are just the masters of flight. They can stay in the air for hours and not flap a wing, and I think that's the most beautiful thing in the world. But now, and within the last 5 years, right in the town of Berlin, there seems to be sometimes 30 or 40 circling above, right above the town, and they nest in big pine trees right in the middle of town. And I was just wondering if there's some kind of a environmental thing that makes them migrate there lately.
I don't live there, but I don't know. But there's a number of things that can happen that, you know, where a species will move to another area. Where I live on the East Coast in Cape May, black vultures were non-existent here when I first moved here. Very rare. Now they're everywhere. And I hate to say that's part of global warming. So they're moving further and further north as the weather becomes milder, in winter particularly. Another thing is obviously birds go to wherever there's more food. Turkey vultures eat on carrion, a dead animal. So maybe there could be some type of, a chicken factory or, something that's thrown out that could be attracting them. And then the other thing is birds of prey in particular have just become really used to humans. And so a lot of raptor species, Cooper's hawk particularly, but other things like Merlin, obviously peregrine, vultures as well, have really become humanized and are really not scared by us. And a lot of them now live downtown. And Coopers are everywhere. If you go into like downtown Los Angeles, they're just all over the place. And again, that's an adaptation to man. And a lot of these raptors are doing really well because of it, because invariably where there's man, there's lots of food.
Yeah, absolutely. Sam, thank you for calling. Appreciate
thank you.
It. Yeah, appreciate it very much. You can join in too, by the way. Here's the number to call with your question, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Are you a birder? How'd you get interested? Raptors, are they of particular interest to you? And maybe you have a favorite you want to talk about? I'm telling you, you're going to get some answers here from our guest, Richard Crossley, whose new book, The Crossley ID Guide Raptors, out right now. And it's a wonderful book. Larry Mueller here. Gabby Pedriani, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, talking about birds and specifically zeroing in a bit on raptors with Richard Crossley, who has his latest book, The Crossley ID Guide Raptors, is a beautiful book. And I think an excellent, if you want to learn about raptors, learn to be able to identify them, I think his book is a great way to do that and accomplish that. You get a lot of help from it. And it's a stunning collection of photos of the raptors that we would likely see here in this country. And I'm great to have him with us today online. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You got a photo you'd like to post or a question, post it right on the Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Will in Roberts, Wisconsin, wondered, Richard, if you could take a bit of time to talk about the migration patterns of merlins.
The migration patterns of merlins. Ooh, well, that's a tough one. Well, the merlins are widespread right across the north as a breeding bird, and like I mentioned before, a lot of them have actually started to adapt to nest in cities, funnily enough, and out in the prairies they. They often go to where like little small villages are, wherever the tallest trees are, to roost in the evening. So while they're out in the vast open expanses in the daytime, right at dusk, they'll come into these same trees every night. And as far as migration goes, because they're all over the north, they'll actually migrate south any which way, along the plains, along the ridges, and they're particularly along the coast. A lot of them fly along the coast, along the beaches. I don't know if there's anything more specific than that I can ask, but they're all over the place, so just keep your eyes out. It's one of those things. They shoot through invariably really quick. They have a lot more direct flights than kestrels do, really short and compact. So invariably, those are the things, small things that just flash by, and before you know it, they're gone, you know?
Dick in Bark River, Michigan, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello again. We have here... where I live, woods and fields, and a breeding pair of bald eagles, which are beautiful and, as your guest said, very unafraid of people. Should I worry about my pure white cat, which is hunting itself, walking down the middle of the road, whether the bald eagles might think look like a rabbit or something? I'm not really worried, but other people might.
I think you have, if you had a goldfish or something, I'd be a bit more worried. No, I wouldn't be worried about your pure white cat. If you have great horned owls, I'd be a little bit more worried. Make sure your cat don't go out at night, because they're the sort of nastiest sucker around, so they'll take just about anything. So it was funny, because I was having this conversation with another bird watcher just down the road, and he was talking about great horned owls will occasionally take very small dogs, so you're better off keeping them inside at night.
Thank you very much. My cat only catches shrews, mice, foals, and no birds. I don't feed the birds. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling.
Thank you.
Jim in Spooner, Wisconsin. Hi, Jim.
Hello, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a friend of mine recently telling me about a bird that he saw show up at his feeder, and he thought it was a striker. And I've never heard of a bird referred to as a striker before. And he said that it would actually, a striker that would actually feed on other birds by ramming itself into another bird, and hence the name striker. I wonder if your guest has ever heard of that before.
No, I hadn't. I mean, there's a thing called a shrike, which will occasionally eat other birds, and it actually impales them on top of thorns and spikes. So there's a few different types of shrikes.
I've never heard of a striker either.
No.
Yeah. Well, maybe it was a shrike, and he was a little bit confused about the name, but interesting nonetheless.
Yeah, they could be, because they really are fascinating. They create, like, these lads, so they'll catch something. And it can be a small bird, but it's often a mouse or beetles or something like that. And they'll get, like, a spike or a thorn, like on a barbed wire fence or just a thorn in a hedge, and they'll actually go and impale it on top of the thorn and just leave it there and come back and eat it hours and occasionally a day or two later. So they're really quite unusual to most other birds by having this lard. So those are shrikes. And round by you in winter, you'll probably get, you could get loggerhead probably, but in winter you'll definitely get plenty of northern shrikes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, that must be what it was. Well, thanks a lot, guys.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling.
Thank you.
Jim in McQuanago, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. You know, actually, I'm I love birds, and I try to take as many pictures of them as I can, but I'm apparently pretty bad at it. I'm just wondering what your guest chooses for equipment. What kind of what kind of lenses? What focal lengths? Where does he locate himself to find the most birds? What technique does he use to get close and not disturb them and to get the picture? Let's hear about the photography end of his work.
Okay.
Okay, that's a okay. It's only an hour and a half program, this one, but I'm a little unusual. Not so unusual now, but when I first got into photography, which is not long ago, I was involved with a book called The Shorebird Guide, and we couldn't get the photographs we needed, and it seemed illogical to me, so I went out and bought a 500mm lens. So that is actually my big lens of choice. And one of the reasons it's my big lens of choice is because I can hand hold it. I don't need a tripod. And so it's much the way as I would hunt. You know, you can stand in one place and wait, or you can actually, you know, you can go scouting through the trees. And so I tend to walk everywhere, and I handhold it because I'm quick and also very agile, and often you'll only get a second or two. I always have my control set. I'm always anticipating for what I'm going to see. So I might change my controls to manual. I may do aperture priority, you know, automatic. But I always try and be ready ahead of the game. So when that opportunity comes and I have 2 seconds to get it, I'm going to get it. I always tend to move quietly and slowly, no quick movements. Movement is okay. It's fine. But it's the quick movements and quick noise changes in noise that scare birds, just as humans get scared, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If we're quiet, sure. We see somebody moving slowly towards us, and they can be making a noise, but it's the sudden change in volume and the sudden change in the speed of the movements that scares birds away. And that's why sometimes you'll go to a... You know, some builders who have got their radio blasting away, you know, as loud as it can be, and the birds are right there. It's just because they're used to it, you know. And then the other thing is I always move slowly but also very low. So, again, if you think as a human, we're scared of things that are really tall and intimidating. So if I'm trying to get up close to a duck or a shorebird, stay really close to the ground, so it makes you look smaller and less intimidating, and move just move very gradually towards them. Even better still, if you have enough time for them to come close to you, because they will eventually. You know, you can do blinds and hides and those types of things as well. Of course, staying in the car is a great thing. You know, it's a very broad question, but hopefully that. You know, answers at least some of your questions.
And what's your favorite lens again?
Well, I have lots. It depends what I'm shooting, but I use a 500mm to try and get when I'm trying to get closer to birds.
Mm-hmm.
And I could use a 600mm, but I cannot handhold them. So I find it's by the time you mess around with a tripod, you scare the damn things away. So you better just, you know, use your hunting skills like, you know, like a hunter would do. And, you know, quietly, slowly, you know, and staying low. And the birds see you. The birds always see you before you see them. So there's no point pretending you're going to sneak up on them. Because if you do sneak up on them, the very second they see you, they fly off, which is sort of counterproductive. So that's, there's no point sneaking up behind trees and that. It doesn't really work very well, you know.
We had a good friend of mine and a guy that I actually rented a house with. Kurt Westberg was a great photographer, and for just shooting birds sometimes that are around our feeder, he'd have his camera set up at the feeder, and he'd get it all focused in and so forth, but very close. And then he had a plunger or a remote, being able to remotely shoot the picture. And you know, he'd leave and birds would come in and he'd be able to snap the photo. And, you know, he's got these extraordinary close-ups.
Oh, yeah, I know. It's like cheating. But I tell you, technology is just remarkable today. And funnily enough, when I first got into it, I bought this 100-foot-long cable.
Yeah.
Because, back then it wasn't remote. And, there was a killdeer nesting in front of the lighthouse. And so I wanted to put a wide-angle lens right next to the nest so I could, you know, get the lighthouse in the background. And so I put this bought this 100-foot cable, and then before I could lay it all down, needless to say, they skedaddled. And I never used it once. It cost me a lot of money as well.
Oh, man. Richard Crossley, our guest today, he's the author of some wonderful books. And the latest we're talking about, the Crossley ID Guide, Raptors. Talking about raptors with him today. You can join in. The number 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show. You can post a question or a comment there. I did have a Facebook question from Jill in Mount Horeb. It says, we've had a red-tailed hawk in our backwoods for about 8 years. Could it be the same one for this whole time? What's their lifespan?
Yeah, no, they're probably up to like 20-odd years old, I would think. I've not seen that many statistics on the life expectancy. You know, and some birds like albatrosses, they get up to like 50 years old. They get up to crazy ages, you know. But it's probably the same pair that are using off. They often use the same nest as well.
Yeah.
So invariably it's the same returning birds.
Bill in Green Bay, thank you for calling. Hello.
Good morning.
Hi.
Morning, Bill.
I have a question about raptors. Do you think they should be controlled because of they're decimating the song for population?
Oh, that's a loaded question, isn't it? You know, I guess I'm a believer in letting nature take its course. You know, one of the problems you have is, you know, often we're changing things, so nature's not actually taking care of itself. It's funny you brought up that question there, because when I got to tell you a little story, I'm probably going to get into trouble for this, but still. When I first came to Cape May in New Jersey, a very famous raptor watch place, everybody was looking at raptors and nobody was looking at warblers, you know? And so I would say, oh, raptors is only a few of them. Why ain't anybody looking at, you know, looking at warblers? They just kill warblers. They should be shot. Of course, it was joking in jest, but it seems somewhat ironic that that question should come along, you know. But they do. It's a good question. I don't think they eat that many birds, funnily enough, compared to other things that cause death in smaller birds. But
windows, for example.
For example, windows. You know, and it is all supposed to be interconnected, you know. As I said, we invariably change the balance of things. That's the problem, you know.
Yeah. What about, well, let's thank you very much, Bill, for calling. I appreciate it. Yeah. Mike in Mauston, it's your turn. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Just got a comment and maybe get your opinion on this. There was a great gray owl this winter in the Mauston area, and there were hundreds of birders that came to take photographs. I mean, people had lenses that were 2 feet long, and then they were using mice to attract the bird to get better shots of the bird. And I think, you know, for people that love that animal, to humanize it like that, I think it's going to meet its demise when it flies near the wrong person by a farmyard or by some kids or something like that, and it's going to die from another human, even though humans are making it come closer to people and that type of thing. I just wanted your opinion on those type of techniques and if that should be done.
And Richard, just so you know, great grays are a rare event in Wisconsin to see a great gray owl, so...
Well, I'm aware of that, and they are stunning. If any of your listeners ever get the opportunity to go see one, they're like the gentle giants, you know, they're just gorgeous. You know, and, that's a great question, and, you know, I've heard this discussed quite a lot. I personally don't have strong thoughts. I have some fors and against of it, really more against. Again, you better let nature take its course. I don't think it makes the birds any tamer, I have to say. Great grey owls are notorious for being tame and being, you can approach them up to a few feet. So that's really not going to change. And often these birds that do come as far south as Wisconsin, really below the Canadian border, they're invariably that far south because they're starving. And so feeding them mice, I personally don't think it's a good thing. I don't think it hurts them. But again, I think you better let nature take care of nature.
Yeah. We have some, by the way, I know you have access to my Facebook page, and we're starting to get some kind of cool photos on the page. I might have you take a look at it at some point, Richard. There's a Alan sent a picture of a Merlin in Lake Park, Milwaukee. We've got one of those. We've got some other, there's an owl. There's a few other raptors photos, so I hope you'll have a chance to look at it. Some really cool photos, actually, on my Facebook page. Tad in Ontario, it's your turn. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Richard, I just want to second what you said about identifying birds. I was driving home last night, and there's a little fish farm that's near where I live, and I saw osprey fold and dive on the fish pond, and even though it was just a glancing sight, I was able to identify it just because of the habitat and its form in the air. So for that beginning birder, the guy that say yeah. wasn't that good, it makes it really good. And now I'm sitting on the side of the road in a flood pond, and I'm having quite a sight. I'm looking at some, it looks like a rail to me. I think they're migratory, moving through. And I took a picture on my camera phone, and I'm going to identify it when I get home and get to a bird book. But, yeah, I just have to second what you said about the habitat and identifying birds that way. That really helps a lot.
Yeah, I think, funnily enough, I love ospreys. We get lots around here. And the habitat and the behavior is really distinctive for them. You know, there's several raptors that hover, but they sort of hover at 45 degrees. And we actually made a composite page with the behavior. And so we had it where it was hovering and then diving, starting to dive, and then diving with its feet out and its talons out, then hitting the water going everywhere. And then when they start to come out of the water, they sort of close their wings and do a little shake, you know, like we do after we've been in the shower. And then they sort of fly off with the fish facing head first. And the reason they have the fish facing head first is for aerodynamics, because sometimes they're really big, so it makes it a lot easier to carry it. And so all these behaviors and the habitat is, like you're saying, is really critical. And for a beginner, behavior and habitat are the two things that every beginner understands. And that's why these obscure feel marks and colors, you know, really hard to see, and people don't really understand them. And even when they're pointed out, invariably they forget them. So, the behavior and the behavior is obviously extra interesting as well, because we all like watching behaviors of people, of animals. We're really fascinated by that. You know, so the more fascinated we are, the more interested we are, the more we remember it, the more we learn. You know, hopefully the book will show that, and a great comment there about the behavior. Thanks for backing me up on that one.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Tad. Appreciate it very much. Got an email from David in Northern Illinois. Last summer, he said, I noticed our cat cowering under a glass top table on our deck. I stepped out to see why, and a red-tailed hawk swooped down within a foot of the table. So the hawk was interested in the cat.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you watch any animals, if they're reasonably small, they'll look up, just as other birds do. You know, so if you're watching some shorebirds or something feeding, and all of a sudden they all stop and stand still, you know, you should always look up, because 9 times out of 10 there'll be a raptor flying over. And even though that raptor typically might not eat that species as food, they still tend to stop, and just in case, you know.
Yeah, just in case.
we would with a big animal, right?
Well, sure. Absolutely. Oh, man. Jan and Nina, thank you for calling. Hi. Oh.
Well, we live on the west shore of Lake Winnebago between Nina and Oshkosh, and at this time of year, we have thousands of ducks in our bay here. We're in a bay, and all different varieties. And we have pelicans, white pelicans. And we also have here, as of the last number, maybe 5 to 6 years, bald eagles nesting, and we have Cooper's hawks, and we have red-tail hawks. We have it all. Well, the other day I went out to fill bird feeders early in the morning, and here was a double-crested cormorant. Just, it was dead on the lawn, and it was, it had been, the neck had been completely chewed apart, et cetera. Could a great horned owl or what kind of an animal would attack this cormorant? And it's a mystery to me. Was it plucked out of the water? Was it ill and it came on shore to die? It was grisly.
Hmm. Wow. What do you think, Richard?
That's a tough one. That's a tough. I don't have a clue is the answer, if I'm being really honest. Not a clue. I mean, a great horned owl, as I mentioned before, will just about take anything. But it could, you know, if it's got something missing in its neck, you know, part of its neck missing, I'd have a look at that and see what the wound looks like, really.
Well, it was just chewed up, too. You know, all the feathers gone, and you could see the, you know, the organs and everything. It was really decimated. And we have a woman that lives down our street that used to do rehabilitation for U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and she had kestrels and barred owls and a great horned owl that she rehabilitated. And this owl stays close. And it is, she helps supplement feeding because it can't fly very well. And we do have another owl occasionally come through because you can hear them calling. So I would think it might be the, owl that's migrated in here to, look for the other owl more so than this owl that Our Lady rehabilitated. This owl Our Lady rehabilitated, you can often see sitting near her kitchen window on a branch, and this lady has a little poodle, and this owl will actually bring, like a mouse or prey, something to the little bird, the little dog, excuse me, as a gift, because she's bonded with this woman and her other animals, and that surprised me no end.
Well, I think that's a rehab thing, you know, when they if they've been in rehab for a long time. You know, birds do become familiar with, you know, other situations and other animals and do treat them differently. You know, they're no longer wild, really. Believe me, a wild one wouldn't do that, and not many things are safe while a great horned owl is around.
Thank you so much, Jan, for calling. Appreciate your call. We have other callers online. I want to give them a chance as well. But just to remind you, Richard Crossley, our guest today, internationally acclaimed birder and photographer, he's been doing it forever, his whole life, and he has a new guide out. The latest is the Crossley ID Guide Raptors. So we're zeroing in a bit on raptors with him today. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. If you got a great photo, we'd love to see that as well. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Zeroing in today on raptors on the Ideas Network, Larry Mueller here, my guest Richard Crossley, internationally acclaimed birder and author of the Crossley ID Guide Raptors, and worked with Jerry Legarry and Brian Sullivan on the book, and also great and wonderful and expert birders. Fun to work with, I'll bet, Richard.
Oh, yeah, great. I mean, they're both very knowledgeable. I've known them from back in the 80s. I'm showing my age here, you know.
Yeah.
But no, really fun. And I mean, Jerry and Brian are known as two of the premier authorities on raptors, so they did a great job on the text. And, you know, one of the things I asked them to actually be the bird, you know. So
yeah,
the introduction sections, they actually talk as though they're the kestrel or the eagle and sort of talk about it from the bird's perspective.
I love that, by the way.
And so, you know, again, it's to try and engage the audience and, you know, and really get the reader to understand that these birds are, they have personalities every bit as much as what we do. And, You know, so if you can really understand the bird's personality, you really get a better sense and of what they are, enjoy them more, and of course you can, you find them easier to actually identify that because of that as well. So,
yeah.
So, I think they did a fantastic job.
Tom in Cedarburg, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, what's on your mind?
Well, I moved to a rural area about 10 years ago, and I like birds up until that point, but since I moved there, I've gotten more interested in birds, and mainly as sort of a friendship, I guess, in that when they call, I'll call back to them, and now that they know I'll do that, they want to call to me, and that can be anything from chickadees to barrels to cranes, everything, even hummingbirds. And this last year, I've started to tape record the sounds of them. And I noticed when I first moved there, when I would hear the barrels, it would be very coarse and very harsh sounding. But now when they call and I call back to them, it's more of a calm, soothing sound. It's like, they don't think I'm an enemy anymore or something. I don't know. But I don't know anyone else who does this. And now everywhere I go, you're frequently, like to work, something like that, there'll be different birds that will come out and start singing. And, I mean, the raptors are not, you know, obviously because they have to be stealthy. It's only, you know, a few times, you know, throughout the season that you actually hear them or see them. But I mean, I've had anything from the small ones that sit on top of wires out in the country. You know, they're only about a foot long. If they have, they'll squeak out for like 10 minutes at a time, and I'll call back. And then, especially by where I live is the barrels, but I've also had great horned owls. And also, once in a while, a large hawk will call out, and, rarely, the Merlins will. They're a very quiet bird. But they're fearless, so also last fall I had a golden eagle that was in a field across from me call out for about 5 minutes, and I've got that on tape as I was calling back to it.
That sounds pretty cool. Comment, Richard, are you good at that, Richard, by the way? Can you whistle and call back?
I wouldn't say it's my specialty, no. I know, obviously, if you play a tape, but people can, can do sounds just as well as tapes if they really practice. And so birds will respond, in part because it's territorial. But in some cases, you know, I was in Colombia last year. We were shooting a TV program with James Curry, and there were some local guys there who were making the sounds of these birds that live on the forest floor called pitters, and they're almost impossible to see, but they started bringing them worms and things, so they'd whistle like the bird did and put these worms down, and the ant pitters had become trained to respond to the whistles because it was dinner time, you know. And so I know some people as well, when they're putting the bird food out, they will actually do some whistles or whatever. And again, the birds are sort of trained to come into the food, you know. So there's multiple reasons. Females will come into, you know, because they want to find a mate. So if you do a sound like that. So there's multiple reasons why birds will actually respond to imitated calls.
Interesting. Thanks a lot for calling, Tom. Appreciate it. I want to give Carol a chance to join in from Milwaukee. Carol, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I just wanted to remind your listeners, or for listeners who don't know, that Milwaukee has a great resource in the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center, which is about 15 minutes north of Milwaukee, just off of 43. It's not only a great place for birders, they have 14 raptors on site, and these are birds that for various reasons cannot be released into the wild, and they often have events with the raptors. So for people who are interested in that, it's a great resource. And they have a web page, and it's www sanc.org.
SANC.org. We might be able to post that up. I'm a big fan of the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center. And Richard, I don't. You probably haven't been there, but I think you'd be a fan of it too if you were once able to get over to see it.
No, I know they do a fantastic job out there. You know, I was out in Milwaukee a couple of years ago, so really great. I know I'd recommend people to go there. You know, funnily enough, we set up a new global bird initiative, myself and a few friends, last year. We're trying to popularize birding around the world, and we have 2 weekends a year, which actually this weekend is one of the weekends, and last weekend in August is the other one. And we had our kickoff last August, and we had some of the raptor folks who have a rehab place an hour north of us, and we had hundreds and hundreds of people just crowded around these birds, totally just fascinated, just love looking at them, you know. And it's great to see the power that raptors have. And I think raptors, more than any other group of birds, bring, you know, non-birders into the outdoors and make them into birders. This book will help. And I think, you know, Brits, actually, we're not so big on raptors because we're an island, so we don't get many. Because raptors hate to cross water, and so we get very few. But so coming over here for the first time and seeing thousands of raptors was just mind-blowing.
And they're so, every one of them seems so regal somehow to me. I don't know. There's just something special about them.
They're majestic, aren't they?
Yeah.
I mean, they're arguably, if not the masters of flying, very close to it. You know, peregrine falcons are being clocked at stooping at over 200 miles per hour. Now, I don't know if that's correct or not, but I know what. Even if it's not 200 miles per hour, it's pretty damn fast. And so you just think about that and take that to the next level. So if you're a small thing going through the air at 200 miles per hour, and then if you think that you're a bird underneath it and you're suddenly going to get whacked at 200 miles per hour, just think how that must feel. And, I mean, there is something about that is just, you know, I mean, I'm not sure what the words are, you know, majestic, powerful, just incredible. And, you know, it's cruel in a way that poor bird underneath is gonna have its demise, but it is nature. And nature is fantastic when you really look at it. Nothing more fantastic than raptors.
Joe in Prairie du Chien, hello, thanks for calling.
Hello. We lived in Central Florida for a number of years, and we drive down from Orlando area to Fort Lauderdale often to see the folks. And around Lake Okeechobee, quite often, we would see caracara. And I thought that would be far too north for their habitat. Is that typical?
No, they're regular around Lake Okeechobee, right in that central, you know, just south of Orlando and around there is like a pretty good stronghold for caracaras in the farmlands. They particularly where there's cattle. You'll often see them on fence posts and actually in the fields, on the floor in the fields.
I'll bet there's some people listening who don't know that bird, or caracara. Can you describe it?
Oh, yeah, a caracara is like a long-legged raptor that actually is invariably seen with turkey and black vultures because it eats carrion, dead animals, just like them. So you often see it next to the roads with vultures squabbling over a dead rabbit or something. And then it's sometimes called a Mexican eagle because, as I forgot the gentleman's name, as he implied, they're common a further south down in Mexico. And funnily enough, so in November, friends of mine with their young son who's 10 years old, driving over the Cape May Bridge in New Jersey, and his mother says, "Oh, what's that?" And he goes, "It's a Mexican eagle." And we actually had a crested caracara right here in Cape May, way north.
Wow.
Identified immediately by this 10-year-old kid who's been birding for like 4 or 5 years without binoculars or anything. So I thought that was a great story. So there was a massive twitch here. A twitch means when everybody goes to chase a rare bird. So we all twitched it and everybody got to see it.
Joe, thank you. Appreciate your call. So you were right, the Caracara. You were seeing Caracara, and you were also right in that it's a normal spot for it to be there in Florida. Well, we're having a lot of fun here talking today with Richard Crossley, an internationally acclaimed birder and photographer. He's been birding since he was 7 years old. He hitchhiked over 100,000 miles by the time he was 21, and he's chased birds across Britain and Europe, and certainly here in the U.S. he's had some fun too. So it's and has produced and written some and photographed some wonderful books. The Crossley Guide Raptors is the book that we're zeroing in on today. And as we talk about birding, that's what we're doing, zeroing in a little bit on raptors, although we're taking a few other questions as well, and certainly inviting your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234. We'll be back with Richard Crossley after a look at the news. Please stay with us. Here in Wisconsin, we're lucky because there are so many amazing birds that either live here year-round or pass through during migration. Raptors, certainly no exception. From the red-tailed hawks to the barred owls to osprey, there are many to enjoy. Hi, Larry Mueller here. They can be tricky to identify, sometimes even for experienced birders, but we have a guest today who's taken a new approach to guidebooks. We're very happy that he has, Richard Crossley, internationally acclaimed birder, photographer who's been birding since 7 years old. His latest Crossley ID book, his Crossley ID guide, is titled Raptors. Richard, thanks again for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Oh, great to be with you, Larry.
And there were, I don't know if you got a chance to look at my Facebook page, but we have photos of Merlin and long-eareds and red-tailed hawks and osprey and other hawks.
Screech owl, eastern screech owl, right?
Yeah, so we've got some wonderful photography, including one, Jennifer, whose husband sat down on the lawn to get a shot of their hawk.
Yeah.
And the hawk landed 4 feet away from him.
Yeah, point blank. It's a juvenile as well. It's a young one. You can see by the scaling on the upper parts. And often the young ones will come closer, you know, than the adults. Adults are a bit more wary, you know. But a fantastic photo.
Oh, it's really, really striking. If you're listening and you have access to a computer, go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Don't have to be a member of Facebook to go to the page and look. I highly recommend it. There's some great photography there. David in Barnes, Wisconsin, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yeah, hi, Larry. And Richard, great show this morning.
Thank you.
I'd like to share a little something about an event, a birding event, up here in the Sawyer County, Bayfield County area. And I belong to an organization, we call ourselves the Nemecogon River Partnership, and we're an organization interested in education and protection and getting people out to enjoy the Nemecogon and its watershed. And so our activities can be anything regarding the river and its resources. And so we had a little meeting here this last fall, and I told them at the meeting that I had visited a pond on my property here, and it's in the springtime, about this time of year. And the off in the distance, here are the mallards and the woodies and the diving ducks out there just making all sorts of racket, but you couldn't see them. And so anyway, this kind of evolved into a plan, I guess, to create a birding event for visually impaired people. And to where we take them out, we go to a great marsh that has a variety of raptors as well as anything else that might be along the river. And so anyway, we've got this planned. It's sponsored by the Nemecogon River Partnership, along with the Cable Natural History Museum and the Sealy Lions Club. And we're looking for we've got a small handful of people, mm-hmm. And so we're looking for visually impaired people that might be interested in this program. So I just thought I'd share that with you and your listeners, and hopefully you might get a call. I I sent a poster to Gabriel and describing it, so just thought I'd pass that on.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Richard, that sounds like a great opportunity for some people and an interesting one. Have you ever been involved in anything like it?
I haven't, no, but it does sound interesting. Yep.
Thank you very much again, David, for calling. Christine and Racine, I'll give you a chance now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you. Have a great day. I'm having one. I just wanted to let you guys know about the Prairie Chicken Festival that was a couple weekends ago. I went up there to Wisconsin Rapids and sat in a blind, and we counted the chicks and the hens and everybody else out there. And on the way home, we went through, well, on Highway S and took the Levee Road and went through, you know, Aldo Leopold, the wildlife refuge, and the birds are out there. We saw so many hawks, so many ospreys, eagles, bald eagles, ducks galore, all the sandhill cranes, blue herring, whooping crane. I was so amazed. We saw the pileated woodpecker, a couple of those. They're like little torpedoes. They're just so fast. just amazing. And so right now in that area on, you know, County Z, it's perfect. It's a beautiful time to get out there. We had to cut it kind of short because we were doing like 20, 25 mile an hour, and it took us a little longer to get home from up in that area. So just wanted to pass that along and make sure everybody gets out there and checks it out. Also, there is a an Audubon bird watch tonight at 5:30 at the Colony Park in Racine, and everyone's welcome.
Perfect. Christina, thank you so much.
All right. Enjoy the day.
Yeah.
And you too.
You as well. Thank you. Nick in Green Bay, hello to you. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me. I had a kind of a question and a little story, particularly with the handling of raptors. My family has, on two separate occasions, actually found downed birds. My mother and sister found a bald eagle that had been hit by a truck, and my father is a big outdoorsman, outdoors photography and mountain biking. He has come across a red-tailed hawk that was, as it turned out, very, very sick. We both times we ended up calling the DNR and finding out what we should do, and with the eagle, the gentleman came and met us out, but with the red-tailed hawk, eventually it ended with my dad putting on big leather gloves, putting it into a large box and just holding on to it for a little bit until someone from the DNR could come pick it up because it was during all the bird flu sort of stuff. And I was just wondering, like, when you come across that, what is the best way to handle a bird like that?
Well, the Department of Natural, I think contacting the DNR, Department of Natural Resources, is probably a very good idea. There is also, I think, there are raptor rehabilitators in many parts of the state, and if you can get to a call to a rehabilitator, I think that also is a good idea, Richard.
No, absolutely. It's tricky, some of that. You know, when do you pick them up, when don't you pick them up? It's really a judgment call, and to be honest, I'm not even sure about the legal ramifications. Obviously, harming raptors is, you know, that's a...
Yeah, I don't think you legally can have one in your possession or try to have one, even if you're trying to be a good Samaritan. I think it's first, it's a good idea to first contact the officials and let them tell you whether you can do it or not.
Yeah, you have a problem because I've seen this a lot where people, you know, pick up birds, not necessarily raptors, and then there's nowhere to take them. They, you know, there isn't a rehab center within 2-hour drive or something like that, and you end up having a problem. And it's a real tricky one with no easy solution in a lot of cases.
Yeah. Let's turn to, thanks again, Nick. Let's turn to Paul in New Richmond. Hi, Paul. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you, Larry, and thank you for your guests. It's a very interesting program here. We're avid birders and do enjoy the raptors a lot. Good time of year for that right now. We're seeing a lot of them come through. But I just wanted to share a brief story of eagle nest that had fell out of a tree after many years. And as birders know, the eagles tend to just build on top of them, and they get larger and larger. And when this nest fell from the tree, when rangers, when they inspected the nest, it was interesting that, and this relates to pets and whatnot that we, you know, was touched on earlier. When they found this nest and looked through it, they found numerous pet collars in this nest. And so it just again, a mention that eagles typically, will hunt, wild game. But if you got a little pet running around your backyard and you got eagles, you might want to just keep an eye on them. So
there you go. Oh man! Well, and they, they're opportunists. I'm sure they tend to eat. I mean, they're around the water a lot, and they're after fish more than anything else. Yeah. I think, aren't they, Richard?
Yeah, they are. But if they're hungry, and particularly if they need to feed chicks, birds are birds. And it's funny. I guess it's like tigers or anything. You have the odd ones that are man eaters.
Yeah.
Doesn't necessarily mean they all are. But no, they'll. The other thing, it depends where they live. If they live in an area where there's a plentiful supply of fish, then they're probably not going to look a whole lot further. But, I think they'll take whatever they need to take. I've not heard of any round here taking pets, but I'm sure in somewhere, like here where the gentleman was saying, they will.
We have Christine in Rosendale up next. Hi, Christine. Thanks for calling.
Hi, it's good to be on the show. I have had the opportunity to see golden eagles twice in the western United States, and just all the words you were using, majestic and all of those kinds of things, seem to be really embodied in that particular bird. I was wondering if that bird is naturally present in the more Midwestern states. And I heard someone refer to it earlier almost as if they had actually had a sighting in Wisconsin. I just wanted some more information about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good question. In this country, golden eagles are commonest out in the Western Plains, out towards the Rockies. But they're really quite widespread out west. And funnily enough, in the east, where they are scarcer, they actually inhabit forests, which is totally different to out west. That's not very well known and not really well understood at this point. But you definitely get them out in Wisconsin in winter.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Especially along the Mississippi.
Yeah.
Right along. And lots of photos. We have of listeners who have actually photographed them, and I actually think we've got some up somewhere on my Facebook page. Although I also see we now have a caracara bird photo, a nice photo of a caracara up on the Facebook page as well. So that's pretty cool. You can join in too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Talking today with Richard Crossley, whose latest book is The Crossley ID Guide Raptors. It's a stunning book. How have sales been going? Pretty well with it?
It's early days. It's only been out a week or two.
Okay.
We've been number one we were number one on Amazon before for the section before it came out. So that's good. We did really well with the Eastern Guide, which really for your listeners right now, that's probably even more suitable because it covers all the birds that occur in Wisconsin. So that book has a lot of the same dynamics. We've been really pleased with that. It won a number of awards.
Oh, yeah, it's a beautiful book.
Thank you. And, we're just finishing off Britain and Ireland. Had to be a little loyal to the homeland, And but the next one, which probably some of your listeners will be interested in, and it may even be a little controversial, will be for waterfowl, so for ducks, geese, and swans. So that's going to be a lot like the raptor. So I know there's a lot of hunters out there. So it's actually going to be for birders and for hunters. So, I think for a lot of people, it's really about the outdoors. And the one thing in Britain, we don't have any hunting. That's an American thing.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, birding is a lot more popular in Britain, particularly among young men. And I think it is because a lot of those young men are really hunters. So they're hunting birds in Britain and they're hunting over here. Because I really feel like the dynamics are actually very similar. You know, we photograph birds or identify them, shoot them or fish and catch them. But I think if you look at it all, it's all the same dynamics, and a lot of it is about being outside, and actually a lot of it is about conservation as well.
Yep.
Ducks Unlimited is arguably the most passionate conservationist in the country and do a remarkable job for preserving land.
Absolutely. Joy in West Bend, give you a chance now. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a comment and a question. I just wanted to say how excited I was to hear that somebody was setting up a birding experience for people who are visually impaired. And I just hope that if they would continue this, then more people would come. But people who are not visually impaired would enjoy also. I've spent a wonderful evening one time with an older guy who we just sat and listened to birds so that I could begin to identify birds by their call.
Song. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, my question is, we had somebody help us build a bird feeder for Baltimore to attract Baltimore Orioles. When are they coming through, or have I missed them?
No, here in Wisconsin, you're going to be seeing them in right around the 1st of May.
Okay.
So it's pretty close.
Yeah.
They're the ones that come to our feeder come practically on the same day every wow. year. I mean, we're talking like May 4th. They're there. So,
all right.
West Bend, yeah, you should be seeing them pretty quickly.
Thanks.
Thank you very much for calling. And Bill in Wausau, thanks for calling. Hi.
Yeah, good day. Just thought I'd contribute that with the ice still on the lakes and rivers, we live on the Wisconsin River just north of Wausau. And we've got the pleasure of enjoying loons calling in the morning as the loons are kind of stopped dead in their migration northward.
Oh, that's a beautiful sound, isn't it?
It sure is.
Richard, have you had the chance? You must have had the chance to listen to the loons.
Incredible sound. I love that sound. And, unfortunately, we're too far south for breeders, but funnily enough, a lot are migrating through now, and unlike red-throated loons, which always stay on the ocean, common loons will, we call them great northern divers, and I like that name a lot better in Britain, but common loons, because there's nothing common about them, they actually fly over land here, and will fly right over Cape May, and they will actually do that call while they're flying over land, so it's really weird, but up on the lakes, oh. What a sound. In the middle of the night, particularly, when everything is quiet, it's unforgettable, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Bill.
Yeah, thank you, Bill.
And we've got Paul let us know that outdoor editor of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Bill Mueller, started a hike across Wisconsin to raise money for and awareness for birds. He's planning to walk from the Lake Michigan shore to the Mississippi River over the next 3 weeks. That could be kind of fun. Tough on your feet, maybe. I hope he's in good shape. He'll be in good shape by the time he gets across. Ted in Chippewa Falls wondered, where do kestrels nest in the winter?
The kestrels don't really nest in winter. They nest in summer. So they go to their wintering grounds in winter to winter, which is usually further south. Odd ones might stay up there, but most birds only nest in summer and breed in summer. And actually, great horned owl, we're back to the great horned owl again. They're actually the earliest nesters, and they'll start nesting like the end of January. And so by now, a lot of the nests, the chicks have already fledged. Most of the birds start nesting somewhere around now, actually, when they first arrive.
I often wondered why those great horned owls start that process so early in the year here in Wisconsin and elsewhere?
Just because they need to show us that they're bigger, meaner, and tougher than everything else, I think.
Sam in Nakusa, Wisconsin. Thanks for calling. Hi, Sam.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
I just wanted to comment about the woman that called a little earlier about golden eagles
in
Wisconsin.
Yeah.
We've had golden eagles here for over 10 years. We're just south in Nakusa, Wisconsin, on the Wisconsin River. And right now we have a nesting pair that's kind of competing with the bald eagle pair that are also nesting. So it's kind of fun to see them flying around and being a little bit competitive. But it's very common for us here. And I know that Marge Gibson up at the Raptor Education Group has gotten an injured golden eagle or two from the Nakusa area. So they're very common right here. I mean, we've seen them for a long time. They're distinct because they have a black tip on their beak, mm-hmm. and they have kind of hairy, furry little legs right down to where their toes come out.
Yep.
And they're big.
They're big.
The bald eagle, at least a 7-foot wingspan from what we can tell.
Yep. Richard? So, well, thank you, Sam. Appreciate it very much. Richard, any comment?
No, I mean, she's right on. I mean, a couple of the easy things to look for is they actually fly with a dihedral, much like a turkey vulture does. So often when you see them up there, and they will occasionally be with turkey vultures, you know, you see their wings in this shallow V, whereas bald eagles are usually dead flat, dead horizontal. And that's a real good way. And usually they have they're immatures, but it takes them a long time to be 5 years to become fully adults. Often they'll, because there's a high percentage of immatures, they'll have a very strong tail band, so like a black tip to the tail and white at the base, and that often stands out a lot as well. And often white linings to the wing as well, a white line on the underwing. So those things are all good to look for.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks very much for calling, Sam. And boy, Richard, the time has flown by for me. I hope it has for you. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it does flown by. I'm obviously doing too much talking.
I'm telling you. No, it was a great conversation. I really, really love your book. I love all your books, actually. And I hope it does very well. Are you going to chance to get out and talk to people about it, I hope?
Yeah, I am. As I said, we're doing the Pledge to Fledge weekend this weekend, so we have lots of events for that. We're actually going up to a very famous hawk place, Hawk Mountain, on Saturday, and we're doing a talk there, and going to be there on Sunday, and Syracuse University on Monday. So, and then the following week, we're going to be out in Indianapolis way, so we're going to be at the big festival out there, so I'll be talking out there, and that's going to be really exciting.
And that sounds like a lot of fun. And here we are out of time. So, Richard, thank you.
Thank you very much, Larry. Hope we get to do it again. Thank you to your listeners. Great questions.
Thank you so much. Richard Crossley, he will be back. We'll visit with him again. Thank you so much for listening. And please stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.